Sleigh bells ring, are you listening? In the lane, snow is glistening. A beautiful sight, we're happy tonight, walking in a winter wonderland.
God, oh, I like this! Oh, oh, I like this! I like to hear that song, Walking in a Winter Wonderland, as sure as my name is Barbie Jones. I'm down here at Sheeple's department store again. I'm looking through the racks, and I don't like some of these T-shirts for my nephews. They still have the skulls on them. I'd like to see something that seems like we've come out of that war in Iraq for good. But, you know, a lot of those men that are coming home from Iraq, they're just going to be shipped over to Afghanistan. But that's the way it is. Oh, here I am in Sheeple's. Oh, I'm having such a good time. I remember the first time I came in here when something happened and the Winter Wonderland really took hold. It was in 2003, that same year that Tommy Franks in Cigar Aficionado said we might have to have martial law. I was just minding my own business, and I walked to the escalator, and I began to fall. Oh, oh, I'm falling like a drone. Oh, I'm flying like a drone. Yes, you see, that was the year that Glenn Spencer had his border patrol with the drones, those wonderful drones that did so much good. I hear now that President Obama is only going to put 300 men on the border patrol. 300 men. That makes me laugh. But anyway, this year, I'm going to get down that escalator again, and I'm going to see if I see that same desperado that I ran into. He was dressed like Santa Claus, and yes, he looked like Darth Vader. I'm going down there now. Oh, I'm falling back. It's like a deja vu. And down there, I see, far down in the mist, it's the same man. He looks a little bit older. He looks a little bit more wrinkled. But he looks just as evil as ever. Hello? Hello? Hello?
Oh, it's that Mrs. Barbie Jones. Oh, and a Merry Christmas to you, Mrs. Jones.
It's Fatherland Security, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, what's new this year? I was reminiscing and thinking back to 2003 when I first met you.
Oh, we've come a long way. You know, according to the Washington Post, December 28th of 2011, actually, this present administration really is attached to the drones. Yes, Barbie, we've moved up from the types of drones you saw in 2003. Oh, we have lots and lots of drone activity in Afghanistan, and someday you might find one in your neighborhood. And also, we have a lot more going on. I don't like Vanity Fair's little innuendos that we've spent $1 trillion since 9/11 to keep America safe from Americans.
Oh, Fatherland, $1 trillion? When everybody's unemployed this Christmas, and everybody's poor, and the families can't feed their children, and all of these Iraq veterans have lost their legs or their eyes, and I just saw one who got the Purple Heart, and he was sitting there, and the Marine commandant was giving him the Purple Heart, but he had been terribly injured with a grenade or one of those bombs right under his Jeep. They didn't expect him to live, but his mother prayed for him and prayed for him. That's the only thing I think that's keeping us together now, is our faith in Jesus Christ.
Oh, we must get religious. Mrs. Jones. And I'll just let you know how things are really moving along out there in Sacramento, California. We have the police now stopping people at the stop signs or at the lights, and they're standing there, the police, I mean, with clipboards, and they're writing down the behaviors of the people they see. How about that, Mrs. Jones?
Fatherland, you yelled so loud, I don't think anybody could understand what you said, but I think that you said the police are keeping tabs on the people using clipboards. I thought only school teachers did that. I didn't know that we were like guinea pigs in a cage, that we're being watched and monitored all the time. I thought it was bad enough with the TSA screeners, but this is a new thing. But I'll tell you what, Fatherland, I'm not going to hang around here too much longer. I'm going home. I'm going to listen. There's going to be a special broadcast. Sally Lou and Pastor Pat...
Oh, the Pockets. Oh, are they still around? They used to be in my hire. They snooped around and nicely for me among the ecclesiastical set. But lately, they've fallen behind. They don't seem to have the right New World Order ideals. I'm going to have to put my rethink campaign on them soon.
Well, anyway, Fatherland, I'm going to go home, and I'm going to turn on MTBN, the Mammon Triune Broadcasting Network, and listen to Sally Lou and Pat. They're going to have a special Christmas. Well, it's sort of like a talk, sort of like FDR's fireside chat. They're going to have that with their listeners. Toodaloo!
Let me get back to my hot toddy, and let me look at the counterterrorism screens. It's not going to be too long now, since the current Congress has given President Barack Obama something that President George Bush never got. That is, the statutory authority to imprison people in military or civilian custody, including U.S. citizens, seized on U.S. soil with no time limit, no charges being filed, and no trial taking place. This power was included in the Defense Department authorization bill that was passed. And all we need now to round them up is an official claim that the targets are connected to terrorism and threaten national security. So what are you going to do about that, huh? Huh? Huh?
This is Sally Lou Pockets, Pastor Pat Pockets, and I are coming to you on the MTBN Mammon Triune Network Broadcasting Network. And tonight, we are not going to be hard-hitting like we often are we, Pat?
No, we're not.
We are really going to talk about the reality of Jesus Christ. Is he still real? Can he still heal people? Is he just a figment of the Jesus Seminar's imagination? I don't think so. And I think we're going to first have this much of a disclaimer that, yes, some magazines can have New Age components. Sometimes they're contaminated. Sometimes they may just be untruthful at times. But if you sift and you look, you can find some things sometimes that do have the ring of authenticity, Pat. And one of these appeared in Angels on Earth. And again, this is a magazine that sometimes seems so good and sometimes has a rather unusual slant with New Age, so we can't recommend wholeheartedly any magazine on this program, but we are going to pick out this story told by Debbie Mosher from Manassas Park, Virginia, and this was back in the 1995, and the headline was this: in a moment of terror and desperation, while my son lay crumpled in the street, I was told exactly what I must do. And it was entitled A Mother's Strength. I believe the year was 1995, if I am correct. So this article began, Pat, by Debbie telling that
She was cleaning the bus that she drove, and this was a school bus. And as she had it parked by her mother's townhouse, she was scrubbing the seats and making the windows shine, and her little son, Travis, was 4 years old, and he was playing inside at her mother's house because she was parked, you see, near her mother's house. And so she thought he was in there, but all of a sudden he looked at her, and she heard, "Hi, Mommy." And then she said,
"Danny, you're supposed to be with Grandma." He was all smiles at the foot of the steps leading onto the bus. "You stay right there," I said. "I'm coming out now." I turned to put down my rag and clean the spray. When I looked again through the open bus door, my body tensed and the scene unfolded like a dream. A black Chevy Blazer sped past. Danny was flattened against his front, as though he had been sucked into the grill work. The driver stared straight ahead in disbelief, his arms stiff on the wheel, as he tried desperately to brake. In horror, I jumped out of the bus, covering my mouth with my hands. After agonizing seconds, the car stopped, and Danny, in T-shirt and shorts, skidded across the searing asphalt on his back and lay crumpled in the street. "Danny," I screamed, weak with fear. I couldn't move. At the back of my mind, a gruesome question hammered away. What if he's dead? What if he's dead? "Not my Danny. Please, God," I prayed. "Not my Danny." A silent instruction directed me. "Run to him." I raced across the pavement and dropped down beside my son. I knew I shouldn't move him. He was unconscious. Another instruction. "Lay hands on the sick and they shall be healed." Immediately, I put my hands on Danny, all over his body. "Please, God, heal my boy." "Come on," someone said gently. "Let's call Victor. The ambulance is on its way." Victor, my husband, was in a house painting job. I didn't want to leave Danny, but a couple of neighbors who had heard the blazes screeching tires took me by the elbow and guided me to my mother's house, where I phoned a message to my husband. I wanted to get back to my son, but when I hung up, another instruction came. Start a prayer chain. Quickly, I called a friend from church. "We're in desperate need of prayer," I said. "It's Danny. He's been hit by a car." My mother took the phone when the ambulance arrived, and I ran to it. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw the driver of the Blazer sitting on the curb crying. Someone helped me into the ambulance, where two EMTs bent over Danny. We roared off, siren blazing. That is, blaring. Lightly stroking Danny's cheek with my finger, I noticed the huge swelling that had formed on the back of his head. "Put your hands on his head." I followed the instruction, my praying and breathing becoming one. But Danny's face turned a sickly purple. The EMTs worked frantically. "We're coming in on code blue," one barked over the phone, that is, over the radio. We burst into Commonwealth Hospital, where our medical team took over. Victor was there, so were a crowd of people, some of them strangers. All were praying for our son. A doctor came out and took us aside. "X-rays show that Danny's neck appears to be fractured," he said. "He's hemorrhaging. We're especially worried about his spleen, and he has severe burns on his back. Danny's chances of survival were slim. He has to be moved to Fairfax Hospital. It's better equipped." Danny was loaded back into an ambulance, his X-ray traveling with him so they could be looked at immediately. Victor and I followed the ambulance to Fairfax, where we discovered another group of people holding a prayer vigil for Danny. Some of them introduced themselves. "I work nearby and wanted to come. A friend called and asked me to pray." All because of a single command to start a prayer chain, I thought. Danny was on the second floor, being prepared for surgery, when Dr. Russell Seneca, the surgeon, approached us, a stillness filled the room. "We have to operate to stop the bleeding," he said. His report echoed the one we'd heard at Commonwealth. Danny was in danger. "Dear Lord," Victor whispered, "be with our boy." Someone grasped my hand. Everybody in the room went down and bent a knee, and we prayed, some of us aloud, some silently. The room seemed electrified with energy, and I heard one man predict with conviction, "There's not going to be any surgery on this child." "That's impossible," I thought. "If Danny has any chance at all, it's with surgery." I thought about all the miracles God had performed already, the instructions he had put in my mind, the number of people he had brought together in prayer, and the confidence I felt that no matter what happened, God would be with Danny. Everyone got up just as a nurse rushed in. "Mr. and Mrs. Mosher, Dr. Seneca wants you upstairs right away." Victor and I, expecting the worst, went to the second floor. "We took another set of x-rays," the doctor said. "That's standard procedure. But the x-rays are conflicting. The second set shows no fracture in Danny's neck. What's more, the bleeding has stopped. There's no need to operate." Victor and I stood silent. "I'm baffled," Dr. Seneca went on. "We all are. We'll keep Danny under observation here for a couple of days, then send him home." For the rest of the day and overnight, Victor and I traded shifts at the hospital. On Saturday, Danny regained consciousness. He was transferred from the ICU to a room in the children's ward, and I sat by his side. "Precious, Mommy's here. You're going to be all right." He just stared at me, not saying a word. Sunday morning, Dr. Seneca released Danny. He would need physical therapy to learn to walk again. The third-degree burns on his back would take time to heal. And, of course, his dad and I worried about the emotional scars. "Keep Danny on the living room couch," the doctor advised. "Let him be the center of activity. Get him to talk about the accident. Anything he can remember." At home, we got Danny settled in the sofa. Mom, Victor, and I gathered around and assured him we would be up and playing again soon. "Danny, do you know what happened?" I asked. Concentrating, he looked at me. "The black car hit me." He was straining, thinking back, trying to find the words in his four-year-old mind. "Is that all you remember?" I asked. His face lit up. "I remember the angel that flied." "There was an angel?" I pressed, wondering what Dr. Seneca would say about this. "Uh-huh, in the ambulance. He put my arm around his neck and flied with me." I was relieved to hear that Danny had been dreaming pleasantly and not traumatized right after the accident. "God is good," I thought. "I saw the man sitting on the side of the road," Danny went on. "He was crying." Danny was describing something he couldn't possibly have seen while he was unconscious. "Where did you go?" Victor asked. "The angel took me to see Jesus, and I sat on his lap. He was bright like a big light bulb. Everything was bright." Danny took a breath and finished. "Jesus said he was going to heal me." From the beginning, God had sent me the reassurance that my son was being watched over. Danny hadn't been dreaming about his angel any more than I had dreamed the instructions that had carried me every step of the way through his ordeal, giving me the peace of mind to cope with the accident. With therapy, Danny learned to walk again, and the burns on his back healed with no scarring. In fact, there was no scarring on his body at all, except for a tiny circular bald patch on the back of his head, the only physical reminder of what had happened. Today, my son is 17, and he likes to be called Travis. He's a big strapping fellow with one more year of high school. He's a certified EMT at Manassas Park Volunteer Fire Company 9, which is just four doors from our home. As a junior member of the fire brigade, he assists at accident scenes and other critical situations, just like the EMTs who came to his own rescue 12 years ago. "Sometimes I wonder why God decided to keep me around," he says. "Maybe it's to help people." When I hear a siren wail, I know that if Danny's on duty, he'll do all he can for whoever's in trouble. And I imagine my prayer flying to heaven on the wings of the angel that flied in there.
And you know, Pat, we saved that article, and it was back in 1995, so now Danny would probably be in his 30s, and such a nice-looking young man he was.
That's true.
That picture, he looked like sort of an angelic child. You know, this also reminds us of something that has happened in this past year with the terrible shooting of Gabrielle Giffords. I don't know whether you saw this, but Pat, there was someone who was working with her on her staff, and he had been in training as a high school kid to do a lot of this thing that Danny is doing, like the EMTs.
Yep.
And so there he was. God put him probably in that position so that he could get to her immediately and do what he should do to help her live till she got the more professional medical help. So you see, God is watching over all of us. He is there, and he cares for you and me personally. And if some of you would like to write to the Divided Kingdom, you can write to the Divided Kingdom at P.O. Box 320, and it's Drasco, D-R-A-S-C-O, Arkansas, and the zip code is 72530. Again, that is Box 320, Drasco, D-R-A-S-C-O, Arkansas, and the zip is 72530. We'd love to hear from any of you who would like to write to us. Now, the next story was also in that magazine, Angels on Earth, for May-June of 1998, Daddy and the Drifter, and this girl, grown up, told about what she had gone through as a child, and she told that her dad was very well liked in the community, Pat. He loved to sing and he told stories, but she said he was, quote, a big drinker and had an eye for the ladies. So she began to tell about the Saturday outings that she would go along with her father on, and she says every few weeks he drove me into town in Betsy, our Model A Ford, to see the new Western playing at the movie house. Then we went to the general store for groceries to supplement the food we grew on our farm. After that, we stopped at one or both of the local taverns, and he sat at the bar drinking while I played in a corner or talked to some of the customers. The sky was usually chock full of stars. By the time we left, Daddy swerved the car drunkenly from side to side on the bumpy gravel road, and I braced myself against the dashboard, wishing we could just get home. But there was still one more stop, a run-down frame house on the outskirts of town. "Be right back, sweetie pie, you just sit tight," he'd murmur, but it was always going a long time, and I was left alone to stare at the dark fields of wheat swaying in the breeze. Occasionally, I'd hear a woman's high-pitched giggle above the chirp of crickets. When I saw him coming back, I'd curl up in a corner of the big back seat and pretend I was asleep. At home, Daddy would stumble through the door, reeking of whiskey and cheap perfume, and I'd hurry to crawl into bed with my younger brothers and sisters. Mama would cry and plead. Daddy would curse and yell, and I'd pull the blanket over my head and try to think about the movie we'd seen. The following morning, Mama would get us all up and off to church early. Daddy would stand in the doorway and call after us, "Don't you all go on down there and praying for me. Now I mean it," he would shout. "I don't want them do-gooders a-begging for my soul." At church, Mama ignored his warnings. "Lord, he's a good man," she'd pray. "Steer him away from liquor and show him the right path." Sometimes the whole congregation echoed her plea for my daddy. Week after week, month after month, they asked God to send my daddy guidance. But his Saturday escapades continued until one hot, muggy afternoon in the summer of 1955. We had just gotten on the main road into town. I tried not to think about how the day would end, keeping my mind on the gentle weight of Daddy's arm around my shoulder at the matinee, the smell of potted popcorn, and which candy I'd pick out at the store afterward. The damp heat had plastered my shirt against my body. I rolled down the window and stuck my face out in the breeze. That's when I saw him, a man dressed in baggy pants and a white shirt with sleeves rolled up halfway to his elbows, was walking slowly along the side of the road. His dark hair was a little shaggy and he needed a shave. "Daddy, look," I called. "We didn't get many strangers in town." "Get yourself inside, sweetie pie," Daddy said, tugging at my shoulder. "I see him." He pulled to the side of the road and waited. The man ambled up to the open window and, without a glance at me, gazed directly at my father. "Howdy," Daddy said to the man, who kept staring at him with the most penetrating blue eyes. Daddy squirmed a bit in his seat and gave a strained smile. "Hop in, and we'll give you a lift into town. 'Tain't a fit day for man or beast to be walking in this heat." The man opened the door and slid into the seat beside me. I scooted close to Daddy and warily eyed our passenger. He still hadn't said a word. Daddy shifted Betsy into gear and eased back onto the deserted road. I'd never known him to be so quiet with company. At last the stranger began to speak, his voice soft and melodic. He and Daddy made small talk about the weather, the scenery, the car, nothing special. Soon I relaxed. I tuned out and wondered how to convince Daddy to stop at the drugstore for strawberry malteds before the movie. Then there was a change in Daddy's tone that snapped me to attention. "What do you mean by that?" Daddy asked suspiciously. "Sometimes in the course of everyday living, we lose sight of what is right and what is wrong," the stranger responded quietly. "We don't mean to do it, but so often we push God aside. But everyone deserves a second chance, don't you agree?" "Oh, no," I thought. "There goes my malted. Nothing ruined Daddy's mood quicker than preaching." I cringed, waiting for the explosion. When it didn't come, I squinted up at Daddy. He had the oddest look. "Let me off up there." The drift of motion toward a dirt path that intersected the road. Daddy stopped the car and the man stepped out. He smiled kindly at Daddy. "The good Lord willing, I'll be seeing you again in a couple of years, Clarence." He stuffed his hands in his pockets and walked a short distance away, then paused and glanced back over his shoulder. He looked at me and I felt a warmth that had nothing to do with the weather. Then he again gazed at Daddy. "Wait 10 minutes before you drive on," he said. We watched him disappear into the nearby woods. "Who was he?" I asked Daddy, realizing there had been no introductions. "How do you know your name?" "I don't know," Daddy frowned as he checked his pocket watch and shifted into gear. "Just some fool, I reckon." It was clear Daddy didn't want to discuss it further. Betsy lurched twice, sputtered, and died. Daddy hit the starter. The car caught for a second, then died again. Cursing, Daddy got under the hood and jiggled some wires, then came back and tried again. Nothing happened. Daddy sat back and stared through the windshield. I waited for him to speak, smile, swear, do something, but there was no sound except our breathing. Finally, Daddy sighed and tried again to start the car. This time, the engine purred immediately. Daddy checked his watch and muttered as we started moving. We rode in silence for a while. As we crested the hill near the Miller farm, a black cloud of smoke shot up from the road directly ahead. Daddy slammed the brakes and we skidded to a stop. Mr. Miller walked over to Daddy's side. "Truck came round the corner too fast. Terrible thing," Mr. Miller said, his voice trembling, as he watched the flames sear the already torrid air. He pulled a grimy handkerchief from a pocket and wiped his forehead. "Just happened about 10 minutes ago." Daddy clutched the steering wheel so tightly his knuckles turned white. He stared ahead, seemingly transfixed by the inferno. After a few moments, he looked at me, his face ashen. He drew me close against his chest, hiding my face from the blaze. We never made it to town that day. Daddy turned around and headed home. He didn't say a word the whole way, and I was the one who told Mama about the wreck. Something held me back from mentioning the stranger. Daddy and I never talked about him either. But Daddy was never the same after that hot summer day. We kept up our Saturday movie ritual, but I never saw him get drunk or visit that old frame house again. He even started going to church with us. Occasionally, he still let loose a string of cuss words, but afterward, he'd look skyward and mutter sheepishly, "Sorry, Lord. Like I told you, I'm a-trying, but I ain't no saint." Soon after his meeting with the drifter, Daddy was baptized in a creek. Folks from miles around came out for it. I can't remember ever seeing Mama happier than during the next 2 years before Daddy died. "I'll be seeing you again in a couple years," the drifter had said. I thought back to that day as I sat beside Mama in the funeral home, and I finally told her about it. When I was finished, she smiled and hugged me. "Your daddy was a very lucky man, honey," she said. "He got to talk to an angel right here on this earth." Maybe he did, because our prayers were answered the summer day Daddy gave the mysterious drifter a lift. And listeners, Pat and I know that God gives second chances. You know, earlier in the Christmas season, I was thinking and brooding about a couple that we know who don't pay very much attention to us, and we go all out for them, and I began to sort of silently list all their faults and, you know, just sort of condemn them and think that I'm better than that. And then I went into the Bible asking God about something, and all of a sudden, there he taught me. There it was, and it was scripture that said basically, if you keep giving to other people, I will continue to bless you, but you can't point the finger. And listeners, so help me, when I saw that, I knew he was admonishing me that my critical spirit, my self-righteous attitude was very wrong, and I prayed for forgiveness. He's giving me a second chance. He gives us second chances. And Pat and I had a very good Christmas. We had some very difficult spiritual attacks, but in the middle of this, there was a wonderful breakthrough, wasn't there, Pat, honey?
That's right.
Something that we had not fully trusted the Lord, and that was what you wanted to say, wasn't it? When I said I was taught that I should not be critical of others, I should show a loving spirit. And you were taught a lesson about fear and not trusting, I think.
Yep, not fear things, because God will provide, and God will be the source of strength at all times.
And he is in control, and we mustn't think that his power is less than the power of the New World Order, because it ain't. And now we hope we'll have a little time here for a really amazing story that Pat's going to present to you. This appeared in a now-defunct magazine, McCall's, November 1996.
And it's entitled, Prayer Saved My Baby. When Tammy Carroll had her first baby, it was a routine pregnancy and delivery no trouble at all, she recalls. Carroll and her husband, Todd, settled into a peaceful life on their farm outside the small town of Nab, Indiana, enjoying parenthood with baby Jacqueline and planning a larger family. 2 years later, in 93, Carroll became pregnant again. Everything seemed normal until the sixth month, when an ultrasound revealed some problems. The baby had chromosomal abnormalities stemming from a condition that is always fatal. Even if the baby lived long enough to be delivered, she would die. The Carrolls were heartbroken. They named her unborn daughter, Megan, and hoped she knew how much they loved her. Eventually, Carroll gave birth, but there was no cause for celebration. Megan was stillborn. Carroll says, "My mother died when I was 20, and at the time I thought there could be no greater pain than losing a parent. But the pain of losing a child was even worse. The couple worried whether the same thing would happen again. Did they have some kind of genetic defect? And what if Megan was the last child they would ever conceive? But medical tests in the Carrolls showed nothing amiss. And eventually Tammy became pregnant again. By this time she was nervous, afraid to get her hopes up. Carroll had grown up a Baptist, but throughout her ordeal with Megan, she had found herself turning to family and friends, not her religion. For many reasons, I had sort of given up on God, she admits. But gradually, as her new pregnancy progressed, Carol found that she was praying more and more. "Dear God, give me a healthy child," she implored every day. Despite her worry, Carol had no problems with the pregnancy. Her obstetrician, Diane Ocon, M.D., monitored her carefully, performing a chromosomal test, as well as extra ultrasounds. All signs indicated that the baby, a boy, would be, of whom the Carols had already given the name Logan, would be completely normal. Logan was due April 9, 1995. But when Carol went to the hospital, make that the office, for a scheduled checkup, on April 5th, she asked her doctor to hospitalize her the next day and induce labor. "I knew she was going on vacation the next week, and I was within a few days of my due date anyway," Carol explains. The following morning, the Carols drove to Clark Memorial Hospital in nearby Jeffersonville. Tammy was admitted, labor was induced, everything seemed fine. Baby Logan's heartbeat was healthy. Todd was there as well as Tammy's sister Ruthie. And the grandparents waited outside. By the late afternoon, Dr. Okren had delivered two other babies and was as ready as Carol to meet little Logan. Carol was taken to the delivery room, and the nurses cheered her on. She pushed and pushed. "One more," a nurse shouted, "he's almost here." But Logan's heart rate had suddenly slowed, and at 4:40 p.m., when Okun took him from the womb, there was no heartbeat at all. He wasn't breathing. As she gave the baby oxygen, Okun told a nurse to call the hospital emergency team. "Come on, Logan," she murmured. "Wake up." In the meantime, another nurse started chest compressions, but the newborn didn't respond. His eyes remained closed, his limbs limp, his color an unhealthy gray. Carol asked, "Todd, why isn't he crying?" Todd stood in shock, watching nurses running back and forth. No one was saying anything. The silence was horrible. Logan, please cry," she thought. Within seconds, it seemed an emergency room physician raced in, followed by Carol's pediatrician, who had been summoned from her nearby office. One of the nurses phoned Corsair Children's Hospital in Louisville, which has a neonatal unit and specialists on call. "What's going on?" Carol sobbed. Tears streamed down Todd's cheeks. "We don't know anything yet," the nurse tried to comfort Carol. It couldn't be happening, not again. Carol couldn't lose another child. "Logan," she thought, "please breathe." Dr. Ocon returned to Carol's side. The specialists, she explained softly, were forcing air into the baby's lungs. Someone injected medication. Someone else was taking x-rays. The medical team was doing all it could. To Carol, it was an unbelievable nightmare. She had thought everything was under control, and now she realized nothing was. Only God could help Logan now. "Dear God," she whispered through her tears, "please don't do this. I don't think I can handle it." The medical team continued to do what they could for the baby, but at 5:15, 35 minutes after delivery, the neonatal specialists who had come from Corsair and the doctors from Clark Memorial agreed to discontinue resuscitation. Logan was pronounced dead. Unobtrusively, a nurse baptized the infant. Another nurse weighed him and cleaned him, wrapped him in warm blankets, and put a little stocking cap on his dark head, and gently lay him in his mother's arms for a final farewell. Carol held him close. "Logan, please don't go. I really need you," she whispered. But her son's eyes were closed, his body limp. She thought, "Dear God, please." She had to let him go to accept the inevitable, but somehow she couldn't stop praying. Dr. Ocon and the pediatrician stood by Carol's bed. The rest of the family had left the delivery room. "We just don't know what happened, Tammy," Dr. Ocon explained gently. "We won't have any answers unless we do an autopsy." Carol blinked back tears. Maybe an autopsy would save another family the suffering she was enduring. "All right," she said, "but I want to hold him for a while." "Of course," Ocon said. Someone brought a consent form, and still holding the baby, Carol signed it. Dr. Ocon left to break the news to the relatives in the waiting room. Minutes later, they came in, their tears mingling with Tammy and Todd's. Todd cuddled Logan, then passed him to Ruthie. A nurse took some photographs. Occasionally, the baby's body moved slightly. The first time it happened, the nurse went out to the front desk to alert Dr. Ocon, who was talking on the phone. Ocon explained that this phenomenon was called agonal breathing. It was nothing more than a spasm or a reaction to the medication the baby had received. At 5:55 p.m., an hour and 15 minutes after Logan had been born, it was time to turn his body over to the hospital. Carol's stepmother, Margie Birch, was holding him, saying a last goodbye, when she suddenly cried, "Tammy, he's gasping. Look, his leg just moved." "It's only a spasm, like the nurse said," Carol answered. "I don't think so. I think he's breathing. Ruthie, get a nurse." Trying to calm the family, the same nurse came quickly and put her fingertips on the baby's chest. Then she reached for the stethoscope and listened. "Wait right here," she shouted as she ran out of the room. Dr. Ocon was filling out forms when the excited nurse approached her. She said, "The Carol baby has a heartbeat." And I said, "The next one to have a heart attack will be me if this doesn't stop," Ocon recalls. But when she reached the room, she could see immediately that the baby was turning pink. "He's alive," she asked. Carol's stepmother could only nod, trembling. Ocon took the baby from her and, astonished, saw that his little chest was rising and falling rapidly. "He is alive," she shouted. "Let's take him to the nursery." She and the nurse ran out of the room carrying Logan. Carol began to weep. She had been grieving for more than an hour. "Don't do this to me again. I can't lose him twice," she cried, as Todd, thunderstruck, tried to comfort her. "We don't know yet what's going on, Tammy," he said. Carol did. "It was just a cruel joke. Your son had been dead for more than an hour. No one came back to life after that. Still, she had begged for a miracle." The news about Logan spread quickly. The neonatologist from Corsair returned. Logan's pediatrician was also there, along with doctors from all over Clark Memorial Hospital, including some not directly involved with the case. Despite the seeming impossibility of it, Logan was breathing on his own. Of course, there were many other matters to be considered, though not mentioned at this joyful, exuberant moment. A baby clinically dead for more than an hour would no doubt have severe brain damage, as well as non-functioning optic nerves, tissue damage, seizures. The list could be endless. But for now, everyone was in a state of awe. It was, as Dr. Ocon described it later, like seeing the shadow of God pass by. Logan was transferred to Corsair Children's Hospital and remained there for 5 weeks. He slept for the first two because of medication to reduce the possibility of seizures. Early signs were positive. While brain-damaged babies don't often nurse, Logan did so immediately. Tests showed that his eyes and hearing were normal. Today, Logan at 19 months is progressing a little bit more slowly than the average baby, but his neurologist is cautiously optimistic that the boy's future is bright. What happened to this very special child, no one really knows. So far, there has been no medical explanation, only theories suggesting that Logan may have undergone the same kind of experience as a drowning victim. When systems may shut down for a time, then spontaneously revive. There's just one problem with this hypothesis. Logan would not have been alive after birth. If the how is hard enough to answer, the why is almost impossible. But Logan's story has touched many, and perhaps that is a reason in itself. Medical personnel at Clark Memorial Hospital have dubbed him Lazarus. Strange has approached Carol on the street with tears in their eyes. A woman wrote to Carol to tell her that the same thing had happened to her at her birth, and that no one had believed her mother until now. Maybe God wanted to show us that miracles do happen. To say, "I'm still here, and I still raise people from the dead," Carol says. And maybe it's not my job to ask why, but just to keep telling others about Logan and keep saying thank you. Tammy and Todd are more than willing to carry out that mission. After all, what else can one do with such a wonder?
And now, Pat, for our listeners, let's read about the miraculous birth of that Savior.
All right. This is from the Gospel of Luke, chapter 2. And it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. This taxing was first made when Cyrenius was governor of Syria. And all went to be taxed, every one into his own city. Joseph also went up from Galilee, out of the city of Nazareth, into Judea, unto the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and the lineage of David, to be taxed with Mary, his espoused wife, being great with child. And so it was that while they were there, the days were accomplished that she should be delivered. And she brought forth her firstborn son, and wrapped him in swaddling clothes, and laid him in a manger, because there was no room for him or for them in the inn. And they were in the same country, shepherds abiding in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night. And lo, the angel of the Lord came upon them, and the glory of the Lord shone round about them, and they were sore afraid. And the angel said unto them, Fear not, for behold, I bring you good tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David, a Savior, which is Christ the Lord. And this shall be a sign unto you. You shall find the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger. And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host, praising God and saying, Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill toward men. Through all the ages since, the splendor of the music celebrating our Savior's birth has continued to thrill mankind's soul. Sella Lou and I pray your new year will be blessed, starting right now as we listen to this glorious music.
Oh. Whoa.